Ladies and gentlemen, well, just gentlemen, welcome to What the Freak.
Yay.
Here with us tonight, the same lineup as last time. We have Idlefire.
Hooray! The crowd goes wild.
We have Terror Bandits.
Boo.
And we have Bluefire. And, of course, myself, Nemesis.
Take them off!
To everyone out there who's come in and commented on the podcast, we have taken on board your comments, and we will be tweaking around and changing the podcast and the how we do it over the next few months. So if you do have any more comments, if you do have any more suggestions or any ideas for what subjects we should do, please come into the forums or on IRC and tell us about it. So our lineup for tonight.
PSTN.
We have Bluefire talking about PSTN and the basics of PSTN. Louis?
That's me. And also, put on, as Nemesis said before, we do actually have females in the group. We do have a 7-to-1 ratio of female on the forums.
Really?
We do actually. It's scary.
Sad.
There's actually, we do want some more comments on the podcast, because I don't think there's many there are. And another thing I was going to say something is shout out to Chillfill for the name, which we forgot to do last podcast. So, yeah, the What the Freak is named to Chillfill. Anyway, back onto my topic of the basics of PSTN. As most of us freakers, we do play around with the PSTN. Like, it does stand for Public Switched Telephone Network, which basically entails ISDN, your normal telephone lines, which is your POTS, plain old telephone systems, and other switching gear for that. You have your strangers, which basically control your switching gear, and you have your end users, which is basically your telephones. Talking about more the physical layers of what most of us are common to know about is the line running between your place and the exchange. For a telephone network, I'm talking about the copper wires. It's not one single copper wire that runs between your place and that. You'll be paired off into a pillar, then from that pillar is another line. So if they find a poor quality line somewhere, they can actually jump you off one pair and put you onto another pair halfway through the track. That's why we have pillars there. Instead of looking after having one big line between your place and the exchange, there's multiple small lines that are joined up to make your big line.
So then, in that case, sorry, just to interrupt you for a second, of a pillar, how many of those would be dedicated and use of phone lines that you can connect to?
Dedicated to that, probably for that area. I'm not sure the numbers. They may range a bit. But they normally are... it's hard to put... to say what names they are.
But you'd imagine most of those pins would be sort of active? If someone rocks up, they'd imagine...
Okay.
Yeah.
Most of them should be active, not just in case you don't find an active line. Like, you may find an active line when you hear dial tone, but you may not be able to ring off it. It may not be an active line. It may be put into... disabled mode, which is basically the only way of actually talking about it.
You get the thing which Bart got, which is just says, you cannot, Telstra wishes to advise that this phone line has been disabled, or whatever carrier owned, you previously had that phone line.
Yeah.
Call blah 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 for assistance.
Most carriers, if it's not being used, will revert back to Telstra. As why would a carrier want to have a line there, still paying line rental to Telstra if they're not going to use it?
Yeah.
Basically, yeah. Your wall sockets to PID in the street, you can, it's the same way, there's no encryption set up on the phone, there's no nothing, that's why Belgian boxing works so easy. Because it's just the same type of phone you're using at the end, you're just halfway down the track, you're just putting it close into the exchange. So in theory, you should be getting better speed. Another thing you may want to do, if you do know where your line is, you may want to, in your pillar, connect up your ADSL modem, and you may be, ADSL 2 modem, you may be able to sync a little faster. But you got to check on filters and that as well. So yeah, that's another idea you could try to find out if what poor quality your line is. Now, that's basically your line run, and if there's any more you want to talk about line runs, about the pillars and all that, the other thing, Now, as you saw the video we posted up on YouTube of the RIM, or the CMUX, which is basically a RIM with an ADSL DSLAM in it. The main side you saw, that was mainly the MDF, which basically all the lines come into it. Basically, then all the pairs come right off into the switching center, which is onto the other door, which you didn't actually see. There's also a battery in there to allow, I think it's 2 days uptime without power. That's just so if the power does go out, you don't lose phones, which is why PSTN is so much better than VoIP. If you use VoIP, you basically lose your telephone to blackout unless you're running UPSs. Basically, the RIMs are basically, they can run a multiple E1 lines, which is basically 30 channels of telephone lines to this one device, which multiplexes out to maybe 40 homes. So you can, they usually overscribe the homes used for the backhaul to the exchange, to the main exchange. You do have your main exchanges, but you also have RIMs out a little bit there that may serve 100 homes to 150 to 200 homes. Not more, usually not more than 400 to 500 homes have been served by RIM. I'm taking the numbers, they're not true numbers, I'm guessing. Like, I've never actually seen a design doc for a RIM, so they could be just made up numbers of what I've seen around the areas of the RIMs I've seen.
I'll probably be able to give you a manual of one of them. I've got a thick-ass, probably about a 400 or 500-page RIM manual with nice fold-out colour pictures. I've never opened one up, and I don't know, as of a video I've seen recently, oh, I'm pretty sure you have, is can you physically connect to individual phone lines through the RIM?
Yes, but it's basically like, it's instead of like, do you know how your pillars, like mostly new, I don't know if you've seen them, because I looked at your video on the pillar, or the picture of the pillar, it had the two lines coming out. A lot of the new pillars now are running IDF type framework, which is not tying onto like a little thing, but actually using quant plugs to plug into stuff and all that.
Yeah,
a lot more of the pillars nowadays are using
sometimes
that.
They run out along the back as well, so they usually leave the pegs there sort of as almost a backup and then have this other infrastructure on the other side.
Then usually you'll find out if one side is going towards the exchange and one side is going towards the user or towards the node. That's what you find with pillars. Okay?
Yeah, and that's so they can test it on either side. So if they want to test the line from the pillar to the exchange, they plug into one side.
Yeah.
If they want to test the line from the pillar to the house, they test that side.
Another thing I've got to talk about is that tools that Telstra do use, like, talking about the voice side thing, not the DSL, because I'm not 100% sure on that, is someone that use a Foxing, which is basically a line, Fox attacker, I think, I can't remember the full name of it, it's basically a line tapper. You add a current, you add a frequency on the one cable, you plug it on one side, and you grab a wand, and it beeps when you get close to it. Which is, it basically helps guys identify cables, which does come in handy when you open a pit and you see five cables, you don't know which one's the one you want to look at. That's what they use the magic wand for, some people call it. I've shown Turbat one of them, what they use for. A funny story I've heard about one of the Camley guys is there was two cables on site working through two different places, and they both plugged into stuff, and they both could hear each other's lines, so they got confused. Talking more about the switching center, you have your different ACTS switches, and you have your DMS switches. Basically, they just basically allow you to switch phone calls and all that. Before that, you had the crossbar, which was a lot more of a physical line changes, physically connecting lines and logical. Because as everyone knows, between exchange and home is all analog base, but once you get to exchange, it's all digital. It's basically all set up in digital channels. A common protocol used to talk between exchanges is SS7, which is Singing System 7, which is the singing thing that talks to, it's just ways of how the rat calls and all that. You have this thing called ABC routing, or call routing. A is the number you're calling from, B is the number you're calling, like 1-800 or 0393 whatever, and C is the number you actually get delivered to. So that 1-800 turns into a real FNN number, which is a full national number, and that turns into that number you want to use. Or if another number has been redirected, it turns into that number. That's what ABC call routing is. Any questions?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Pretty comprehensive.
Yeah. Another, that's why you see the hand, like, the telephone, okay, Lawrenceman handset is basically the same as normal telephone. Like, they do have some more functions. Like, the only one I've seen different is an ISDN one, which basically has an NT1, which is basically an ISDN translator on it. But ISDN's a lot different used than the normal PSTN. Basically, it's a two-channel phone line over a single copper line. Then there's an article written up there somewhere. I'm not sure if I put it on this page, but there's an article I read on ISDN. If anyone does want me to get talking about ISDN, let us know, and I will do an ISDN talk next time. But I believe that most of you won't be concerned about ISDN, as it's more of a business telephone line, and most business telephone lines don't just use two-channel ISDN, they use like 30-channel ISDN.
Well, very simply, just to break it down.
It's pretty outdated by now, isn't it?
Yeah, what's the real benefit of using ISDN nowadays? Is there any?
There is. Actually, you have multiple phone lines that are the same line. A lot of companies, it's mainly pointing for company market. Like an ISDN basically is a connection, like a lot of ISDN back in the old time were connections between exchanges as well. Like they use the same technology from between the company that was used between exchanges. They had E1 line between exchanges and two exchanges that may have like four E1 lines used and so on. An E1 is basically a 30 channel ISDN card. Or an ISDN interface. It's just basically a way of having your signaling system put it to another channel. That's what out-of-band signaling, as we all know, plus in-band signaling. Anything else on that?
Not really.
As we do know, there's each wire from the exchange usually have two pair. Each of the pair, I think it's a ring and a tip, is your two lines you usually use. Not sure if they have the real names for them, but it's the ones I got told, the ring and the tip. And you should know how the voltage is. Once you pick the phone up, a voltage does drop up. Once you pick the phone up, the circuit is broken instead of the circuit being making. That's how the phone knows you've been taken off the hook.
Is the power provided by, if there's no RET between you and the exchange, the power down the phone line is provided by the exchange then?
An RET isn't actually, like, I don't know where you got RET in there, like, you'd never have an RET between your exchange and the line. Do you mean a RIM or do you mean an RET?
Sorry, yeah, I mean a RIM.
Okay, sorry. Power is still provided by the RIM.
I'm being confused too, yeah.
Okay, the RIM, your power is supplied by the batteries and the thing if the power goes out. The power for the line is also exchanged by exchanges, by the telephone exchange. Most of the telephone exchanges I have usually have a battery and backup and also a generator on site, which can provide, I've been told, 2 days life, 2 to 3 days life. So, usually they can find out that stuff. Any more on that?
I think that's it. I think we're ready to take an ad break. Our first ever ad break on What the Freak. We'll be back soon.
Do you want freaking ebooks, movies, software, and other accessories? No problem. Check out freakfiles.com. That is freakfiles.com. A part of the ozfreak.com network. Time once again for Hacker News.
This is Hacker News with Nemesis. In the top of the news today, China denies net censorship. A Chinese delegate to the United Nations has been quoted as saying, "In China, we don't have software blocking internet sites. Sometimes we have trouble accessing them, but that's a different problem." Exactly. I've been to China.
That's the stupidest cop-out I've ever heard.
I've been to China, and I know for a fact that they block the internet as well as they block television. Because I remember watching CNN and mysteriously when they were talking about something about Taiwan, the reception kept dying.
Nah.
Interesting.
Cunning.
Yeah, and he used the example that members of people in his office were able to look up the BBC. Well, that's because they work for the government. They can do what it wants. I mean, and people were just, they said that the United Nations Council wasn't very impressed and completely didn't believe China. And I don't think anyone does, really. In second bit of news, we have Seagate has... will, in early next year, release a hard drive with encryption device built into the hard drive. The encryption device will be a 128-bit key AES encryption. Now, the issues that we have with this is that many countries still consider it illegal not to give up an encryption key when demanded to by a court of law, which means that, yeah, I mean, you can keep encryption.
The encryption key is basically useless.
Well, yeah, I mean, you can continue to refuse to a court of law, but you'll be held in contempt until such time. You can be held indefinitely, as long as you don't hand over the keys. But some issues raised also were that the data is unencrypted as long as the computer is not completely switched off. So as long as it's not hard switched off, as long as power hasn't been cut to the hard drive, you're still considered as authenticated. This is an issue in laptops predominantly. And considering that the new hard drive will be primarily promoted towards laptops, the first hard drive to come out will be a laptop hard drive. This is a real issue because people generally just turn their laptop into standby and hibernate, which means that the laptop is still vulnerable and that it's actually being authenticated.
If you think about it, how many hard drives get stolen out of computers for, like, data theft? I think that's the whole encryption thing kind of sounds pointless if it's only sort of working when the hard drive is off.
Generally, because the theft of the computers generally happens, like, it happened to the government, I think, last year. Someone walked into the building and just stole a few computers. But it happens regularly to businesses where laptops go missing.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
It's got to be niche, though,
where
surely.
Laptops just... Yeah, it is niche, but I think they need to really... figure out the problem of it being able to switch off. I mean, I think the fact that if Windows is locked, then or some other method of it switching off, just a timeout, really, if the computer isn't used in a certain amount of cycles, then it locks itself, like Windows locks itself, and you have to enter the key again. And that's not that hard to implement. But what it means is that you'd have to implement probably another layer of security in order to protect the hard drive, which is just pointless. So in other cryptography news, we have Windows Vista Blocker, Windows Vista's BitBlocker will also incorporate an encryption method that uses AES. To encrypt an entire hard drive. This is obviously used to target the PGP whole hard drive encryption program, which is a corporate program which you can buy. However, what was amusing was when Microsoft denied that the encryption technology would enable criminals to store data so securely that it would be out of reach of the police. The Microsoft employee who was Microsoft spokesman claimed that you can always break an encryption algorithm if you throw enough horsepower at it. Now, for anyone who knows...
Good luck with that.
Yeah, for anyone who knows anything about AES, the minimum key length of AES is 128 bits. That's 3.4 by 10 to the power of 38 keys, possible keys. Alright, that's a fuck load. And it would take, I think, approximately 149 trillion years to actually crack that using, I think, every computer in the world. So, it's not feasible. That statement is true. You can, if you throw enough horsepower at it, you can break an encryption algorithm, but nobody has that kind of horsepower. I think we can safely say.
Not for a while, anyway.
No, not for a very long time. And unless the NSA has some pretty in-depth knowledge about AES, that means that they've been able to break it down to a less amount of tries.
I'm sure Google could do it. Just...
Well, they've got a few Gibsons lying around.
Yeah, a few million Gibsons. I mean, it just amazes me that they think that they can claim this sort of thing and get away with it, you know.
But hey, good for us.
By the time the computer horsepower catches up, you'd assume the security will improve as well, and the whole thing will be a nice...
That's the idea. I mean, the AES goes up to 256-bit keys, which is 1.1 by 10 to the power of 77 possibilities. And, yeah, that's going to take a lot longer. That's exponentially longer. You're not talking about two times as long to crack the keys. You're talking about 2 to the power of 128 times longer.
Exactly.
Or something ridiculous. It's, yeah. That's just a general guess. So,
all right, I'm going to speak for all of us when I just say, holy crap. That's a, wow. I'm going to start using 256. That's pretty tough.
Yeah, try
encryption.
Yeah, try 1024. I think that's some companies.
I was using like 2048 at one point, and I'm beginning to think that that's a little overkill.
What?
Using 2048 encryption.
Yeah, it is a bit overkill. Depends on the method you're using. If you're using something like DES, then it's reasonable, because DES is broken to shit. But something like AES or PGP, it's just over the top. It's unnecessary. So in the final lot of news we have tonight is Windows XP Firewall ICS DOS attack, which enables you, through a specially crafted packet, to disable the Windows Firewall through a denial-of-service attack that will crash Windows Firewall. Now, usually I look at DOS attacks and go, it's not boring because they generally don't have much application in the real world, but this one, by disabling Firewall, you can obviously launch a wider variety of attacks on Windows machines. Now, the only problem with this kind of attack is that not only it disables the firewall, it disables the internet connection sharing, ICS. So if the box you're trying to attack is in fact behind the firewall, you're not going to have any luck. So has anyone got any comments or any other news that they'd like to share?
Just regarding your article you wrote recently about rainbow tables.
Yep.
Had a bit of...
To pimp that.
Yeah, a bit of interest, just from your average website hitter. And what was your address again, just for the people who wanted to check it out?
0xdecaf.ozfreak.com. Unfortunately, the .com hasn't propagated yet, but we're still waiting. Should be up soon. But yeah, Rainbow Tables article, there's also an IPND article up there about the integrated public number directory. And some code as well should be released, and I'm working on some other articles to release as well, and some other code. So it's going to be, I'm going to try and keep getting it updated continuously.
Are you intending to leave it as a personal site?
Sounds fantastic.
So are you hoping to leave it as a personal site, or do you want to find a few more authors to help you write some articles?
I'm encouraging other authors to get involved. I've got a friend at the moment who wants me to help him out in writing a tutorial. We haven't decided what it's going to be about, but it's probably going to be about the integral workings of an operating system and how operating systems work from the ground up. Very basic operating systems work. Anyone can submit an article, and if I think it's relevant and good enough, I'll release it. I'm encouraging a lot of other people to release articles because, I mean, it makes it easier on me. I don't have to think so much.
Cool.
But, yeah, I'd really want... And it also means different kinds of content. I mean, I'm very interested in specific fields, and I want other people's input, and I want other people to express what they want, what they have.
That being said, just sort of plug it off now. OzFreak.com is still offering practically unlimited bandwidth if someone wants to open their own site as a subdomain, something .osfreak.com. And all you have to do is get in contact with us on IRC. Yoink. Yeah, on anything, and we'll and we'll get a site set up for you.
And either me, Idlefire, Loopfire, or Terrapanda can organise that for you, so if it's just around, just ask us. There are a lot of other
domains
as well. There's Laconics, apparently, .networkpunk.com. There's Ziki.osfreak.com. There's VSP.
Currently not finished.
Yeah, VSP's going up. Mobiles.osfreak.com, which is DS69. Fag Hat's site. We've got a whole lot of different ones. There's CCP.osfreak.com, West Coast Freakers as well, WCP, SCP, everything. It's all going back up, so should be a lot of different, and I think other freak files are going up, as well as some more movies and stuff, so yeah, keep your eye out.
If you want some great hacking tutorials, I suggest you go and have a look at laconics.networkpunk.com.
Yeah.
And plug.
Ideas, advice, or comments on the podcast, or freaking in general, hit us up on our forum, osfreak.com, and leave a comment.
Welcome back to What the Freak. I hope you enjoyed our very first ad break ever. To get off, start things off for the second part of this podcast, we're going to talk about, I'm going to talk about OxDecap, which you can see by going to 0xdecap.com, my new website. This is meant to be a very a different community, sort of encompassing the same sort of people, but the idea of the website is to release articles in a more professional manner, to release different bits of code, proof of concept code, as well as articles that are more refined and more well-researched than the usual stuff that we get through the forum. So if you have something that you've been researching or you've been working on in the last few months, then feel free to talk to me. I'm willing to help people write up articles, to proofread the articles, to make sure, you know, that they flow, that they make sense. And I'm also prepared to put up stuff that into the source code section that is unique, but also offers some educational purposes. So that's basically what I'm looking for OxDecap. Generally related around computers, specifically computer security, but I'm willing to go broaden out into different spectrums. We're looking at releasing an article very soon about how to track errors in object-orientated programming languages, specifically C++, so, I mean, I'm open to a lot of things, except for men. What we're going to look at now is I'm going to give you an introduction, a basic rundown of my latest article, which is Rainbow Tables Explained. The article talks about the way Linux stores stores Rainbow Tables, because we're using the example of MD5. So first of all, I'm going to give you a rundown of how Linux stores passwords, which is that it stores it generally. Most newer distros, distributions use the /etc/shadow file, which means that this file is only readable by root, which means that other users cannot read, a user cannot read another user's password hash. When the password is first entered, Linux takes a predefined plain text, and uses the password as a key to encrypt it. Now, this sounds a bit odd, but it makes sense if you think that the password is what we're trying to keep secret. When the whole key system for encrypting and decrypting different plain text was developed, the key was indeed the key. It's what needs to be kept separate. The plain text. If the plain text is known and if the ciphertext is known, then nonetheless the key has to be unbreakable, even if both the plain text and the ciphertext are known. So that's why we make the password key. if we treat the password as plain text, then the key would have to be predefined by the operating system. Then, if we put, you know, then so if someone easily, you could just look at the source code of the distro, then you would automatically be able to decrypt anyone's password at all. So, this would defeat the purpose of the entire algorithm. Algorithms are built to keep the key secret of their entire, that's how they're built. When someone enters a password attempting to log into a machine, password is then provided to use the key and is then encrypted, used to encrypt plain text, and the resulting ciphertext is compared to what is stored in /etc/shadow. If it matches, the user is authenticated. So what this whole article is about is to give a very basic rundown of how time-memory trade-off works. Many papers out there, including the recent one which we've released on Millworm, will have you believe that rainbow tables simply take every possible password in the set parameters, such as alpha or alphanumeric set range, say 1 to 7 character length, and produces a hash for them, which is then stored in memory and referenced by a database. While this is not entirely incorrect, it does not reveal the true aspects of rainbow tables and how they use time memory trade-off. While rainbow tables do indeed produce every possible hash, or at least most of these hashes, they don't store them. And so what I'm talking about in this article is how they do store them. How they use chains to be able to, what is called time memory trade-off, to reduce the amount of memory needed. If we were to store every possible hash for, say, MD5 or even Landman hashes, and it's plain text, you would be talking about terabytes of data having to be used up. So this is why we use this concept to limit the amount of space. So I think, if you've been researching a subject like this, you want to learn about this, or you want to release an article, go see 0x0xdcap.com or come talk to me in IRC. So I think we have next is Idlefire.
Thanks a lot. Alright, something we've been working on recently is, if you haven't noticed, things like the podcast, which are great, and even though we've only actually had one rollout, even though we've had about 3 or 4 attempts of it, another thing we're starting to dabble into now is the idea of just making videos, short things, usually a couple of minutes. So far they've been mainly just little tutorials, but I'm sure as we go on we might have get-togethers, we'll meet up and have sort of a video podcast and actually talk face-to-face about it. So, so right now the 3 we've got done, the first one was done about a couple of weeks ago, which was done by Bluey, and it was pretty good. It was horrible quality, but it was of a rim which that opened up, and it was just going through where everything was, how everything worked. And, it got on YouTube pretty quickly, and it's starting to get more popular. Recently, as in yesterday, I've rolled out a few more, very basic little guides on how the beige box works. The first one, which was just a tutorial on sort of how you can set your beige box to be more efficient by, rather than actually splicing your phone cable, you just make an add-on, which is something hopefully we can look into a bit more. Second video is just explaining how to actually beige into a pillar. All these videos are accessible either on YouTube, youtube.com/users/ozfreak, ozfreak, or through freakfiles.com/movies. And hopefully, by the time this rolls out, there'll be at least one more, or if not, a few more. And that's about it. Make sure you have a look and hit the forums for more information on how the videos are going.
Alright, so that's about it, isn't it? I'll just mention quickly about Ozfreak, the website, and the new shop that'll be opening in 2 weeks, hopefully. Halfway through the design stage at the moment with the shop. Hoping to have a massive product range, starting with anything to do with pretty much phones, lock picking keys, that sort of thing. Probably doing a lot of, you'll be seeing a lot of improvements happening on the site itself in the next few weeks. Gonna change up and have a few optional themes for everybody, so you can choose a lighter theme if you like, or stick with the original dark one, and probably some definite improvements in the full-on cascading style sheets sort of design. That's about it. So can anything, anybody else think of anything to add to this podcast?
That's about it.
Yeah. I got one thing to add for it.
Yeah.
Our next podcast, I'm going to go through a basic rundown of VoIP, IPTel, and also I'll be going over a basic rundown of mobile phone stuff like it's just here with the PSN today. Okay, guys? That's for me. That's for my one for next podcast.
Cool.
All right. That sounds pretty good.
What we might do next time for the next podcast is physically record little segments of our own, like almost like reporter stories, us actually, you know, reporting on something, and then we'll sort of splice it in just to give the whole thing a bit more flair. You probably would have noticed by the time you actually listen to this, we've got a few little things we're going to splice in here. We've got ads going. Any other ideas for ads, definitely hit us the forums and give us some ideas, either for your subdomain or just fun ones for things like Telstra.
Actually, that's something I will add. At the bottom of the actual main page on Ozfreak, there is the... stop singing the next theme song, Castle. Anyway, yeah, at the bottom of the main page on Ozfreak, there is space for banner ads, so I might post up in the forums. If anybody wants to create a banner ad for their subdomain, and we'll post it at the bottom there. That way you can just have, like, you know, say, for example, not picking any favourites, but, you know, like CCC Freaks, and then just have a little description under, like, the logo and all that sort of stuff, and that way people can see it and click on it and go to your subdomain. I'm also thinking about starting up, like, a review section for each subdomain, that way you can go and have a quick rundown, look on what each subdomain has to offer. And also, yeah, as Idle just said, maybe we could start doing some domain ads. Like, obviously we can't plug everybody's subdomain in the one podcast, but we could certainly slip two or three in each podcast, just if you want to create your own ad and email it through to us or something, we can chuck it in. So don't forget that we now have probably over 2,500 subscribed users on iTunes. That's about it, really.
So, all right. So that's What the Freak, signing out. Thank you for time.
Bye.
Dude, have you heard the new PLA Radio podcast? Holy fucking shit, dude, yes I have, that's the best motherfucking show I've ever fucking heard! Oh my god, oh my god, oh my god, I know, the prank phone calls and the humorous skits of the fucking bomb, yo! No fucking shit, dude, in episode number 2 I learned how to scam businesses out of classified information! Oh, and oh my god, goddamn, remember the episode where he prank called the fucking Brady Bunch? Ah, fucking shit, that was fucking funny, but holy shit, holy shit, holy shit! Oh my god, what the fuck's wrong, dude? I can't remember the URL to the goddamn website, and I really want to listen to the latest episode! I know what it fucking is, it's motherfucking www.funlosers.org! Oh my god, fucking sweet, I can't believe it, thank you, dude! Hi, you're so fucking welcome, let's go listen to some PLA Radio right now!
Oh my god, fucking PLA Radio, www.phonelizards.motherfucking.org.